The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Well, there's a row, several rows in fact, in the European Union over vaccinations. James, the EU has told Pfizer to warn them when they start giving more jabs to Britain. To explain a little bit more about what's going on and why here.
The EU's vaccination programme has not got off to a rapid start. It isn't vaccinating at the pace that the UK is or the US is. And I think that is causing tensions in the bloc, and the EU is trying to get on the front foot. It had a big blow recently because Pfizer and BioNTech, who produced a vaccine in Belgium, announced they were going to refit the factory there to try and increase supply. That was going to lead, though, to a temporary reduction in supply. Then, much to the EU's annoyance, AstraZeneca, whose Oxford AstraZeneca Zab has not yet been approved by the European regulator, but that's expected to be approved this week, said that they were cutting their supplies to the EU by 60%. And the EU were very cross about that. And I think what the EU is trying to do is it's trying to say to its plan that you have to notify them before you export COVID vaccine. It's trying to ensure that it basically gets first dibs on the vaccine made in the EU. So, for example, on Pfizer-BioNTech, if Pfizer hadn't delivered everything to the EU, I think the EU would object to them fulfilling their contractual obligations to the UK by exporting there. At the moment, the EU is stressing this is purely about notification to ensure that they get what they're contractually entitled to. But it's very easy to see how this could turn into a situation like it did with PPE last spring, where essentially states scramble to keep hold of all supply and essentially kind of borders reassert themselves. And I think we are quite close to that situation. I think you see here that the EU is very frustrated at the pace at which it is being able to vaccinate and is worried that it is essentially kind of losing out on supply, either because of the Pfizer reconfiguration or with AstraZeneca. I think it doesn't understand how AstraZeneca can supply 100% of what it's promised the UK, but only 40% of what it promised the EU. Now, I think the answer is that the UK was sufficiently worried about this that it basically set up a UK supply chain for the production of this vaccine, which is kind of seems to be working. And then there is a kind of separate factory base for the EU production of this vaccine, which doesn't seem to be producing at the volumes that AstraZeneca hoped.
Katie, the AstraZeneca story has been quite a roller coaster over the past 24 hours as well, hasn't it?
Yes, so there's clearly tensions building between the EU government and Oxford AstraZeneca. Also, by extension, perhaps the UK is going to be affected by that in terms of what we're seeing on exports. But I think where this took a twist that no one saw coming was you had a German paper published last night, reports saying that officials in the German government had said that the efficacy on the Oxford vaccine, which is yet to be approved in the EU, but we believe is close to being approved, was a mere 8% among the over 65s. Now, if that were the case, that would be incredibly troubling, and there'd be serious questions about MHRA approval over here, and also the rollout so far, you know, the numbers we've been looking at. But clearly it's so startling, you had to ask questions as to, well, someone's got something disastrously wrong here. And there was a very quick slapdown from AstraZeneca saying this was completely incorrect. You saw the UK government, who I think are pretty seething about this whole episode, kicking back as well. And now we have a situation where the German government have also said they do not recognise this. So whoever in government was supposed to have briefed this, there's now a clear line that they don't recognise it. And actually what it could be referring to is the fact that 8% of those in the study were over 65. So something's gone wrong there. there. Someone's having a very bad day in the office. But I think what it does point to, though, which is there's clearly negative briefing going on. It's clear that tensions are souring between, you know, the EU as they're looking at who is to blame for their vaccine programme. And something got misconstrued. But the tone of what was being put out, this person spoke to, was ultimately one of raising questions and doubt about the Oxford vaccine, which is interesting if you think about the whole picture. And then I think we still got to wait, as I touched on, for the Oxford vaccine to be approved. Something else in that report that has been elsewhere is this idea that it might be approved by the EU with an age cap, so it would be approved for below XX number, not for the elderly. That we do not know if there is truth in it or not.
James, the UK's vaccine success story is something that other countries might legitimately feel envious of. But in terms of infection rates, other countries may feel a little bit less jealous of what's been going on. And we have a COVID-O committee discussing how to try to contain the spread of the virus today. Tell us what's likely to come up.
So this is the question of hotel-based quarantine a la the Australian model for people arriving in the country. I think the big question to be decided today is whether this will apply to everyone flying into the UK or purely people flying into the UK from places where there are concerns about new variants, so Latin America, Southern Africa. I think at the moment it seems more likely that it is going to be the latter. And I think it's probably that with probably some tightening up on the quarantine restrictions for everyone returning to the UK. You know, I think one of the things that the UK has struggled to do is to kind of come up with a tech solution to quarantine to make sure that people really are staying where they are, where they've said they are, or on their quarantine form.
Yes, we're expecting, but clearly the meeting needs to conclude, the priority at the very least to be the countries which have the strains of most concern to the government. I think there's still a question of how quickly they can put this into action. There were reports last night that hotels are preparing for changes imminently, but I think that the impression I've got is this could be, you know, a few weeks to get these things set up because of the administrative effort that is going to be needed. And I think there's an interesting one in terms of the parliamentary party, because actually, it does seem as though this border policy of a clampdown is popular, but there's also already this talk of no summer holidays. And I don't think the parliamentary party has yet come to terms with the idea that this policy might mean that no one is going abroad, if that makes sense. I think it's seen as a short, medium-term measure, which is perhaps not what Number 10 have in mind.
James, we've had a game-changing intervention from the Labour Party in the past 24 hours, where they've asked the government to confirm something that the government has said all along it's going to do.
Yes, to make sure that schools are the first thing to reopen. I think the schools question is particularly difficult because, first of all, there is the social justice aspect of schools being closed, which obviously is going to widen the attainment gap. You know, the fact the government felt the need to immediately cancel exams at the same time it announced that schools were closing was, I thought, very revealing. And then there's also the economic fact. You know, some analysis done for the government at the beginning of this showed that one of the biggest economic hits of a whole crisis is closing schools because of how it hits the ability of parents to work and contribute to the economy. So obviously kind of reopening schools is going to be the priority. I think the hope had been that they would go back after the February half term. I think that now seems less likely. And I think now the question is whether they go back before Easter or not. I think over the weekend there was a kind of suggestion that the schools might not go back at all this term. And as you pointed out, Isabel, that drew quite a furious reaction from Tory MPs. And I think the government is now trying to say, look, we will try and get them back this term if at all possible. Now, we know that Gavin Williamson, having gone through the situation last time round where Boris Johnson appears on Andrew Marr on Sunday and says, send your kids to school tomorrow, Monday, and then announces schools closing on Tuesday, that there now will be a two-week notice period to give schools and families time to get ready for whether schools are going to be, when schools are going to open again. But I think that certainly in political terms, reopening schools is the most important thing for the government to be able to do, to start to say to people, like, look, there's not only the vaccine light at the end of a tunnel, but we are heading towards some easing of restrictions and, you know, normal life, or something approaching normal life, will return at some point.
And we've also had Public Health England making an intervention, actually, and suggesting that opening primary schools after half term, they believe, is something that would not significantly affect our number. They think that would be a possible thing to do, which I think will become even more pressure on the government to move. And therefore, we might have a situation where primaries before secondaries or all these that could start to be the political argument.
Thank you, Katie. And thank you, James. And thank you for listening.